they really didn't think it was a good idea. And I said, I think it's a good idea. I think Betty Gordon will relish the job of chairman, and Harry would love to be continuing it, and so on. And so this is, they've done a good job. They've worked together very well. And the board had some more misgivings and then said, well, we won't make the call. They said, we want you to make the call. As the guy that knows this company better than anybody, you decide whether this is the right call to make. And I had so much personal involvement, I couldn't make an objective call because I was worried. It was not the best thing for Amgen at the time, but I felt that I had every justification for doing it. So I said, I'll make the call, and I will resign, and you will put them in. And they said, okay, you say it's going to work, it's going to work. And Harry Hickson lost his job 3 months later, and that was really tragic in my book. He was a big asset to the company, but he had conflict. And so as soon as I was gone, I knew I was the glue, and the glue's gone, and they blew him away. Glenn blew him away as their CEO. And and there was it was nothing I could do about it at that point. And if he didn't want to work with them, if I make him chairman and CEO and he doesn't want to work with the guy we've elected as president, he's not going to be happy there. Something's going to break, so I guess it has to be that the one guy goes that I didn't want to lose, because I thought Harry was extremely valuable, very, very, very talented guy. So that was the downside of the whole thing. The people at Payne Webber were euphoric. It was so successful that when we went back to the Payne Webber brokers again the next year for a public offering, but a second offering, we had great success. When we went back again just 2 years ago in 1997 with a limited RD partnership, which is one of the things we'd done at Amgen, limited RD partnership for $87 million, that sold out like hotcakes. That's already paid off. Those investors, after 2 years, have all their money back by a factor of two. So the role for me at ICOS was very well established, and it was an essential role, and it was one I felt I really ought to play. And it's been an easy thing to say I really like that. Now I'm in the pain again, all over again, as of 2 months ago, because we've spent about 2 years trying to find a CEO at Amgen and at ICOS, and we just hired the guy for CEO, and I once again see the situation where you don't really have a job when you're chairman. You do it for a while because you want to be sure the transition is solid. Uh-huh. And then you just have to face up to the reality. You know what? This time I did it for a totally different reason. I was 71 years old and had told the board a couple of years ago that I'm going to have to face the reality. I'm not going to live forever, and I better not be there in the saddle when something bad happens, so we have to get the replacement. There's been a kind of a mixed feeling on the board as to whether it's the smartest idea in the world or not, to whether I should stay and continue to serve time. I would, from a personal standpoint, I would prefer to be president, chairman, and CEO of ICOS than retired, independent chairman or any other job in the world. I think this is the most fun job there is. So I with some reluctance, realized I couldn't keep doing that. So now I'm chairman, and I'll probably have to decide over the next year exactly what that role should be, and exactly whether that's a role that should again be ceded to the new CEO at the right time. And then the question is, what do you do? And this goes back to father. Somebody was asking me about my father the other day, and that is, I guess that's a standard question. You got to know what your father was like. My father was working on the day he died when he was 80 years old. My brother was working on the day he died when he was 70. He was 78 years old or 77 years old. So there's something in genes that I really think is there, but it's also a role model situation where there's a lot of excitement in having a job that you feel like you're doing pretty well and that people seem to appreciate. And it's a nice ego trip, and it's fun to be on it, and I've been on it for a long time. So I don't really look forward to saying I won't do that. However, with ICOS, I assume that will happen, in which case then, if anybody wants an old, used-up brain and body, why I probably would entertain some other kinds of responsibilities that would be very helpful to some startup or something else. I certainly have no appetite to be involved. I mean, the bigger the company, the less interest I would have, because I think the part that's really fun is getting your hands around science and the people and the dynamics of getting things going. So I would probably be involved with things like that. But maybe not. I might not find that it's too bad to be spend more time with my families and grandchildren and so on. That's always possible. But I strongly suspect I'd rather not make that a full-time deal. So that's the transition all the way beyond to the end now of the HICO story, because that's where I am. I'm at the chairmanship and no longer CEO. They had it right in the introduction, but they didn't have it right in the book because they had me still as chairman, president, and CEO. Yeah.
Well, I mean, looking through your resume here, I think you may be a very qualified consultant. You could probably find work somewhere.
Yeah, I might get work. Yeah.
Well, even if you're out of a job.
I do need it to sustain the livelihood that I've gotten used to.
But, yeah, you can always come here. And I'll give you an office upstairs.
Oh, is that right? Well, this is the best deal I've had this week. Yeah, okay. Is there anything else you want to hear?
A little something about, I don't want to duplicate like what you've done, given us today in your talk, but, you know, you were saying, like, when you're trying to market the industry, the company, you don't want to just, you know, throw out there, you know, there's going to be this intersection between, you know, information science and biotechnology somewhere, you know, 50 years down the road. But what do you, you know, say, look at 8 years at Amgen, 8 years at ICOS, the industry has changed. What do you think, you know, the next 8 years of, you know, of a biotech?
Yeah, that's an easy question. I can put on my visionary hat once in a while. I really don't like the word even of being visions. The visions relate to me something not very real. And if you get carried away with how good something sounds instead of being able to weigh its probability, I find that to be a typical example is how many people want to do the research to tell the study of what programs to fund. So they move in the direction of which is the biggest payoff instead of which is the direction of the highest probability of success. And you have to have something in between. But if you totally ignore probabilities and gravitate toward where the big payoff is, you don't get there very often, because you've got a very big number times an unknown which approaches zero, and the product is well established at zero. Zero times anything still comes out, except if it's infinite, then it's an indeterminate. But every other time it's zero. So you better think about twice about the fact that this is so attractive because it's so big. It's attractive if it's feasible, if it's viable, if you can do it. So the first thing to prove is that it is truly viable or feasible. And I think the same thing should be a measure of where the world is going. I think do I really accomplish something by imagining a world that has everything I could ever want? I have computerization and biotechnology and everything solving all the problems in the world, and yet if the probability of that in my lifetime is zero, I don't think it has much meaning. So that's all I was trying to say is that there are so many tangible things that I can be almost certain will happen. And they're actually very wonderful also. And I gave you the list in the thing there, and I'm saying those things are going to happen. And even some of the things that only involve molecules, words that we've now described that we haven't understood how they fit into human therapy, they're going to even be paying off in the next 10 or 20 years. So the payoffs are very tangible and understandable, but they're not as dramatic as the concept that I'm going to have a chip around me with me and it's going to automatically program drugs into my body that are going to solve all my problems based on my genes, and things that are so possible but remotely possible and so unlikely in the next 20 years that I really don't care about them. And so I don't really like to sell that level of futures where the probability has gotten so low that it's almost trivial to talk about it, because it probably isn't going to happen. So what I feel is that the clear picture of the future is very promising, because, hey, I can see that we understand cancer better today than we did a few years ago. Just a few years ago, we have much more information in the last 3 years. The whole story is very similar to what we had about 3 years ago with AIDS, where about 3 years ago people were wondering, how can you know so much about the AIDS virus, more than you ever knew about polio or smallpox, and yet you haven't solved the problem? And the answer is, hey, look, this is real progress. We know so much about the AIDS virus, we will solve the problem. It's going to take some more time. It's an insidious virus. It does terrible things to exactly the kinds of systems that in the past we've enhanced to try to beat a disease, and we can't use it because it dismantles that part of our immune system. But we're going to solve the problem because we've got this incredible level of understanding of that molecule. And the problem is not solved today. It's still not solved. But now I think it's pretty clear that the progress was almost inevitable because of the knowledge that we have. And I feel that we're getting to that point with cancer where the knowledge is now so great that we're going to solve that problem, and it's going to be now in a very finite period of time, and it's going to be very important. And I think some of the other things, the aging question that I've hinted at,
yeah,
is a little more problematic, but I think there's going to be some really important things that come out of that work. But there it might not be what people would ask for. Namely, you're going to have
George, I made a very powerful telephone call because it materialized.
Oh, for God's sakes. Oh, there, hi. Well, we're just about ready. Yeah, it should be. I'd say we're 10 minutes.
All right, whatever.
Sorry, I didn't realize they were.
Yeah. Okay, what was
yeah, one? We were with what's going to happen in the next
year.
Oh, yeah.
Cancer's on the verge.
There's one that I tend to be pretty conservative. When I see that the feasibilities are low, I think those things deserve to be in our minds and if in the vernacular of 3M, on the back burner. So you aren't shoving it up to the front and putting coals to it. If I had a little more time in the speech today, I might have thrown in some slides that are very interesting. One was that the number of people we had on EPO in 1982 was 2. The number of people we had on EPO in 1983 was 3. In 1983, he cloned the gene. The number of people we had on EPO the next years were 20 and 30 and so on. So it's not so hard for me to decide to control my enthusiasm until I really see feasibility. It means that you don't ignore those things that have very high payoff. It's just that you keep them in balance and don't get carried away in proportion to the potential payoff if, in fact, the probabilities are very low. So in looking at these things that are coming along, I've been unimpressed with the idea of grabbing a hold of gene therapy, for example. Gene therapy, by careful analysis, looked like it was fraught with enormous risks and probabilities much lower than would be true for just finding an exciting protein and putting it on the market. I have been relatively cool on antisense because it had the same situation. I am very glad that progress has been made. I think it's wonderful. And I certainly wouldn't be opposed to finding a company like ICOS watching a technology like that as it begins to develop, pay the full price for it when it's feasible. Somebody says you can get it so much cheaper when it's not feasible. And I think, yeah, is that cheap? That's going to be a very expensive price tag. So I tend to be a bit more conservative than you might think of someone that's so willing to start new things. But I feel like, gosh, it's more fun for me to have kind of a track to run on than just totally random experimentation. The track to run on still might mean a tremendous amount of divergent thinking and a lot of approaches that people might have to think about and discover that they haven't even thought of yet in order to make it successful. But I have a feeling I got my hands around it, and that's a lot more comfortable for me. So we don't have any gene therapy going on in ICOS, yet I put it in there because I think there's no question about it. With a certain amount of time, it is a solution to many, many, many problems.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be huge advances in all the sciences move so fast that I'm very optimistic. But I think there's a surplus of things to work on already, so I might as well pick the ones that have pretty good high probability that they're going to work. And a very important part of that is the patent system, because if you're doing something novel enough to be patentable, it doesn't matter if you're chasing after something that five other guys are chasing after, because if you get the patent, you're not guaranteed of having five guys on your tail. Whereas sometimes these popular fields, you automatically know you're going to have an awful lot of company. And that's not so easy to decide. I'm going to do the thing that really looks good because I'm going to have everybody else in there with me. But if I see a way to get a patent or some other kind of intellectual property protection or other kinds of protection, then that combination of knowing what I might be able to protect and the fact that I might get there first, therefore, and get that protection, it's worth racing to do some things that are, in the sense, kind of popular things. Solving cancer is certainly one, but every approach is different, and there's a very good chance that the ones we're working on are going to offer us a real significant protection if they happen to work, and we have some reason to think that there's some progress there. So even though we're an inflammation company, we found ourselves with some technology that fits into cancer the same way as male erectile dysfunction is sort of been backed into it, and we're happy to pursue those things when we think there's feasibility. And that list of things I showed today are just scratching the surface. I mean, if you want to name a disease, there's going to be enormous progress on it in the next 5 or 10 years. Is it going to be solved? Is it going to look more like AIDS at that point where it's partially solved, or is it going to look more like multiple sclerosis, which partially solved today, or is it going to just continue to elude us and perhaps be viewed as an almost inevitable consequence of that we can't solve the problem. And I just don't accept very many of those. I'll accept death as a consequence we aren't going to solve very quickly, but the rest of them I think we're going to be able to deal with in time, because I think there's an awful lot. I mean, when you finally have a molecular description of every part of the body and know what every phenomenon that's going on right down to molecular level, there's a hell of a chance you're going to be able to do the right things to prevent those procedures and not introduce problems that are more serious than the thing you're trying to cure.
Okay, you want to let him carry his family for a little while?